If you would, grab a Bible and let's be turning to Exodus chapter 20. I heard about a survey that found that more Americans today can name the seven ingredients in a Big Mac, and that would be two all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun, and the six kids in the Brady Bunch, Marsha, Jan, Cindy, Greg, Peter, Bobby, then can name the Ten Commandments. Now, hopefully, though, after this series, that won't be you. Now, from time to time, you'll hear the term Judeo-Christian ethics, and it's used in different ways and for different reasons, but it's often referring to these principles that are found in the Ten Commandments or Decalogue. That's the name that they're given in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Deca, ten, logos, word. The name that you use to try to impress your friends. Don't you know the Decalogue? But anyway, after the ten plagues and Israel's release from their Egyptian bondage, we read about that in the book of Exodus. The people agreed to obey and to do all that God commanded, Exodus chapter 19 and verse 8. And so, beginning with the Ten Commandments, God revealed His law to His people. The Decalogue, okay, it's very short and it's very simple, and yet it's very profound. It's had a tremendous influence on the world. There's some, like Dennis Prager, who will argue that, quote, no document in human history so changed the world for the better as did the Ten Commandments. And we'll go on and on about how it's influenced Western civilization. Well, the NIV Study Bible puts it like this. The Ten Commandments are the central stipulations of God's covenant with Israel made at Sinai. It is almost impossible to exaggerate their effect on subsequent history. They constitute the basis of the moral principles found throughout the Western world, and they summarize what the one true God expects of His people in terms of faith, worship, and conduct. Well, something special. These are not just spoken, but written by God Himself. As Exodus chapter 31 and verse 18 says, when he had finished speaking with him upon Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone, written by the finger of God. And then you may remember in chapter 32, where Moses, he came down from the mountain and he discovered that the people, they had made a golden calf and they were practicing idolatry. It came about, as soon as Moses came near the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing. And Moses' anger burned, and he threw the tablets from his hands and shattered them at the foot of the mountain. And so they had to be remade. Now the Lord said to Moses, cut out for yourself two stone tablets like the former ones, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets which you shattered. So be ready by morning, and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai, and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain. Since he broke the old ones, he had to carve out some new ones and carry them to the top of the mountain. I'm sure there's got to be somewhere in there a lesson on self-control. Also, we find that the Ten Commandments were repeated in Deuteronomy chapter 5 for the new generation after the wilderness wanderings. And there, while the same, they have a bit of extra explanation from time to time, which I'll point out to you. Now, before we begin going through the Ten Commandments, we need to ask the question, are Christians today still under the Ten Commandments? And it may surprise you to discover that the answer is actually no, we are not. When reading through the Bible, you need to keep your covenant straight. In Deuteronomy chapter 5, in verses 1 through 3, we read this, hear, O Israel, always pay attention to whom you're speaking, the statutes and the ordinances which I am speaking today in your hearing, that you may learn them and observe them carefully. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. And that's another name for Sinai. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, speaking of their forefathers, but with us, with all those of us alive here today. And then he went on to list the Ten Commandments. It was not the covenant that he made with our forefathers, and it is not the covenant he made with us. In the Bible, we find three distinct covenants or dispensations, which I've tried to illustrate with some clip art. We find the patriarchal age between the creation and Mount Sinai, where God mainly, he would mainly speak to the patriarchs of the families. We find the Mosaic age between Mount Sinai and Calvary, where God gave the law of Moses and spoke through his prophets. And then we find the Christian age between Calvary and the second coming of Christ, where God spoke through his Son, who gave that word to his apostles. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. Now, what you need to realize is that the law of Moses was designed to be temporary, to fulfill a specific purpose. And Jeremiah made it clear that there was going to be a new covenant. In Jeremiah 31:31, he said, "Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." And he went on to explain some of the differences in this new covenant, which are clearly seen in the New Testament of Jesus Christ. And Hebrews chapter 8 quotes from this passage and talks about it. Well, in Galatians chapter 3, verses 23 through 25, Paul, speaking of the law of Moses, said, "But before faith came, we were kept in custody under the law, being shut up to the faith which was later to be revealed. Therefore, the law has become our tutor to lead us to Christ, that we may be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor." The Hebrew writer spoke of the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, as a shadow, and said that Jesus is the mediator of a new and better covenant, and clearly tells us he takes away the first in order to establish the second, Hebrews 10:9. Read Hebrews chapters 8 through 10 sometime. But some try to say that it was only, it was only the ceremonial part and not the moral part, that is the Ten Commandments, that was taken away. And that might sound okay until we look at passages like Romans chapter 7. See, in verses 1 through 6, Paul said that we are dead to the law and released from the law. Well, we then learn what law he was referring to in verse 7. "But now we have been released from the law, having died to that by which we were bound, so that we serve in newness of the Spirit and not in oldness of the letter. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? May it never be. On the contrary, I would not have come to know sin except through the law. For I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, 'You shall not covet.'" So as you can see, he quoted the 10th commandment. We are dead and released from the law containing and including the 10 commandments. Now, this is not at all to say that the Old Testament is not of value for Christians today. I mean, the Old Testament is a priceless source of information. In fact, it would be difficult to understand the New Testament without the Old Testament. It's the foundation, and it's just filled with many, many important principles. Romans chapter 15, verse 4, and 1 Corinthians 10:11 both say that it was written for our instruction, but we are not to use it as the authority for how we worship and live as Christians. There are many people who try a syncretism of the Old and New Covenants. They create their own customized blend of religion by mixing the Old and New Testaments to suit their personal taste. The Christians in the first century, they had a problem with this from time to time, as the Judaizers would come in with their teachings. And that's why the Apostle Paul told the Colossians, "Therefore, let no one act as your judge in regard to food or drink, or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day, things which are a mere shadow of what is to come. But the substance belongs to Christ. Those were things from the Old Covenant. Now, many people, they get uncomfortable when you tell them that we are no longer under the Ten Commandments. Does that mean that we're free to practice everything the Ten Commandments forbid? No. Today, we are under the law of Christ, as Paul called it in 1 Corinthians 9 and Galatians 6. And his law includes 9 of the Ten Commandments. We don't murder, commit adultery, and steal because of what the New Testament teaches, not the Ten Commandments. Now, think about the different sets of laws that have been enforced in America. The British ruled America from 1620 until July 4th, 1776, when the Americans began to rule themselves. Now, the British laws did not allow stealing and murder, and the laws of the United States do not allow stealing and murder. So, when we abstain from stealing and murder, is it because we are under the authority of England or the United States? You see, even though they both forbid those same acts, we still recognize that we are under a different set of laws. The fact that there are similarities does not mean that American citizens can combine the two or pick and choose to suit their own personal taste. American citizens do not live according to British law or any previous law of America, but according to the latest and existing recognized law. The same is true for God's people when it comes to the Old and New Covenants. The Old Testament is true and just filled with important principles that we preach and teach from, but it is not to be used as the standard of authority for Christians. All right, with that in mind, let's go through each of the Ten Commandments. We'll make it through the first two today. We'll see what they say and see what the New Testament says about each one. Now, you'll notice that 8 out of the Ten Commandments are in the negative. You shall not, and 2 are in the positive. Remember and honor. And also we can see that the first commandments deal with people's vertical relationship with God, and the last commandments deal with people's horizontal relationship with other people. Now, there are some who combine verses 3 and 4 as one commandment instead of 2. And then they'll have either verse 2 as the first commandment, which I think is actually the preamble or the introduction, or they'll divide the 10th commandment into 2. I would say that how it's divided is relatively insignificant, as long as the teaching remains the same and nothing is left out. Okay, so number 1, no other gods. Verse 3. You shall have no other gods before me, or besides me, as my footnote says. In the Bible, there is strict monotheism, one God, which is very different from the pagan nations around them, which believed in many other gods and worshiped them. Polytheism, that's what we call it. God was demanding absolute allegiance. They were to be exclusively committed to Yahweh, the one true God. Deuteronomy chapter 4 says, "Know therefore today and take it to your heart that the Lord, He is God in heaven above and on earth below. There is no other. So you shall keep His statutes and His commandments." Now, among other things, that means that there is only one moral standard, and you can't go to another god for a different moral standard. Deuteronomy chapter 6, it says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might." The Jews often refer to that as the Shema, from the Hebrew word for hear. This commandment came first for a reason. Okay, it is the most basic, and if it is followed, it will change how one views the creation, how one views others, and how one views him or herself. In Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32, Paul, he talked about some of the terrible things that people are guilty of, and the main reason given is because they had quit worshiping and honoring the one true God. In 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 6, after mentioning the many gods that are believed in, Paul said, "Yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and we exist for Him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we exist through him. Now, if you do some research, you will discover that all humanity, throughout history and in all cultures, is incurably religious. The atheist has been an exception in every society. I mean, even now in America, when atheism is so in vogue, it's still less than 10% of the population who say that they are convinced atheists. But of course, you could argue that atheists, they still have a God. It's just themselves. Or maybe their faith in modern science with quotation marks or metaphysical naturalism or something like that. Well, in the book God's Psychiatry, Charles Allen gave this illustration. At Vicksburg, Mississippi, an engineer showed me an almost dry channel. He explained that once the great Mississippi River flowed there, but now it had been changed into another channel which had been dug. The flow of the river could not be stopped, but it could be diverted. So with our worship of God. Man is incomplete without an object of worship. The yearning of his soul demands attention. But man can turn from the one true God and make for himself another God. It seems that we're all going to believe in and worship someone or something. But what that is can be diverted. It can be directed either to or away from the true God. And so is your God a God with a lowercase g or an uppercase g? Okay, number two, no idols. There have been many people throughout history who have tried to whittle God down to a size and a shape that they like. So verses 4-6. You shall not make for yourself an idol, or it could be translated graven image, or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. Just speaking of below the ground level at the surface of the water. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. Well, an idol, of course, is a figure made of something like wood, stone, or metal, and it's an object of worship. And the phrase, or any likeness, that would encompass any image that's not covered by the term idol, probably for those who like to argue semantics. Now, this would apply to a representation of a false god, but it would also apply even to the true God. God is spirit, John 4 and verse 24. And so any idol that was intended to represent him, to resemble him, it would be a misrepresentation of him. In Acts 17:29, Paul said, being then the children of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. It simply comes from the artist's imagination. Now, this might bring into question the use of statues and paintings of Christ, which is fairly common today. Now, obviously, you've got to ask what they are used for. The problem is using images as objects of worship. The New Testament clearly speaks against idolatry in different contexts. 1 Corinthians 10:14, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. 1 John 5:21, little children, guard yourselves from idolatry. Idolatry is mentioned in Paul's deeds of the flesh in Galatians 5 and so forth. Now, first world countries, we don't have a problem with worshiping literal idols today, but we know that just about anything can become our idol. Colossians 3:5. Therefore, consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which amounts to idolatry. We can worship gold instead of God. Now, I like the way Prather put it. In short, even in contemporary life, there are many potential idols. Antique tables, doctorates, cocaine, the U.S. presidency, Corvettes, the flag, the Lakers, sex, church services, the environment, stocks and bonds. Not that all these things are intrinsically evil, but anything to which we ascribe undue power, anything, no matter how good, to which we devote our lives at the cost of our relationship with the Almighty, can become our idol. So we all have gods, even atheists. Most gods are the wrong ones. It's been said that there are six objects of worship that people in our culture frequently put before God: wealth, fame, pleasure, entertainment, power, and education. Now again, many of those things, they are not at all bad. They're not bad in and of themselves, but are we putting them before God? Do they take priority? Do we worship them, as it were? And it's very interesting that many of the pagan gods promised these things. They promised the different things that we worship and pursue today. It's been said that Satan is just rebranded. That's all. Back to Exodus chapter 20. Now, verse 5, it's not speaking of petty human jealousy. Being the true God, he will simply not tolerate the worship of fake gods. Just as a husband is not going to accept his wife being unfaithful and cheating with other men. I mean, what husband is going to go along with that? What husband is going to think that that's just fine? In a sense, God was the nation of Israel's husband. And idolatry is often pictured as spiritual adultery. Now, you may be asking, what in the world does visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children mean? Now, this question, it comes up because the Bible clearly teaches that we will all have to give an account for the choices we have made, not for something inherited from our ancestors. For example, Ezekiel 18:20, the righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself. The entire chapter of Ezekiel chapter 18 talks about that. It's not passed on or inherited, but upon himself. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. And there are many, many other passages that teach the same. I like how Roper explained it. The statement that God does this presents a problem, since Deuteronomy 24:16 and Ezekiel 18:20 say that children are not to be punished for their father's sins. No contradiction exists, since Exodus 25 is speaking of the consequences of sin rather than the guilt of sin. A father's sin can negatively affect his family for three or four generations. His children are likely to learn his bad habits and become like him. Then they will suffer for their own sins. In addition, the consequences of sin, sorrow, sickness, humiliation, incarceration, and early death can scar a family for generations. The Israelites demonstrated that fact when they were taken into captivity. Innocent children had to suffer the consequences of deportation with their guilty parents and grandparents. Then he went on to say, the contrast between three or four generations and thousands emphasizes that God rewards obedience even more generously than he punishes disobedience. And this must be speaking of negative or positive consequences. Your choices, they can certainly affect your children and grandchildren and the blessings coming from God. The point is, if you want good things for your family, well, then you should worship and obey the true God. So as we can see from these first two, which are certainly, they are certainly repeated in the New Testament, the one true God is to be at the top of our priority list. We may need to do some self-examination. Who or what is at the center of my life? You know, what is it that truly has hold of my affections and my worship? As we learned from our recent series with Gideon, we may need to go home and start tearing down our family's idols and altars to false gods, whatever they may be. All right, next week, we are going to continue with commandments 3 through 5. Jesus, well, he said the two greatest commandments in the law were to love God and to love your neighbor. You're going to notice that all of the Ten Commandments can fit into either one or the other. See, if you love God, you'll fulfill the first ones. And if you love your neighbor, you'll fulfill the last ones. Now, there is a problem. No one keeps God's laws and standards perfectly, neither in the Old Testament times or the New. Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So what's the solution? Well, Romans 3:24, being justified as a gift by his grace through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus.